I would very, very much like to have started this episode by talking with you about demons who pass gas, invade pigs, and cause homosexuality. I would love to talk to you about that story, but no. We have some interesting news here in the land of Ask an Atheist, that is Pierce County, Washington, and you are indeed listening to Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Becky. How are you, Becky?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to learning about fart demons.
And Bridget, for your second time behind the host desk here.
Yeah,
indeed. There is, I don't know if you remember, last summer, we had somebody talking about giving money, county money, to a evangelical Christian camp, which you were saying is currently under fire in Portland?
Yeah, it's actually an after-school program called the Good News Club, and they exist in various pockets of the country, and it's evangelical. Right now, they're trying to get in on the action of Portland public schools and use school facilities for after-school time. And
right.
Anyway, we could touch on that for a full hour, but basically,
but indeed, this
evangelical
is
proselytizing to kids,
right? But this is the guy doing this here in Pierce County was Pierce County Council Member Jim McCune, and he's bringing a resolution to post the motto "In God We Trust" in council chambers in downtown Tacoma. The Republican from Graham calls the slogan inspiring and patriotic. Council members Connie Ladenburg and Rick Talbert of Tacoma oppose the measure, acknowledging the possibility of controversy. Talbert said the council should try to be inclusive of all citizens' belief and not a single belief, even if it's the belief of the majority. Council Chair Dan Roach supports the motto as reflective of the principles our country was founded on. Oh, boy.
But
Dan Roach. Yeah. Dan Roach was the guy who decided to give me a class in how politics works in the middle of council chambers.
Because you've addressed these guys before.
Yeah. Yeah. I've addressed these guys before. And trust me, I will be addressing it again. But I'll tell you, the folks from Connie Ladenburg and Rick Talbert, you're right. This will bring controversy. I'll make sure.
Yeah.
Because that's my job as a citizen. And, the principles our country was founded on.
Well, and the thing is that McCune also was saying that, you know, I just really want to appreciate our heritage. Nothing recent motivated me to do this. It's just, you know, our national heritage is the thing that's motivating me to do this. Not the In God We Trust America movement trying to get In God We Trust displayed in every darn little council chamber across the country.
Yeah, I really like how he can, every time something like this comes up, he plays stupid. And I mean literally he plays stupid.
He's playing?
Yes, he is. Okay. He's not as stupid as he plays off. I really can't speak to his actual intellectual level because he's a really good actor. But what we have here is he's saying, well, I don't know about all this stuff going around across the country. I'm just doing what I'm doing because I care about Pierce County. Except what he seems to be doing every time seems to be matching up with some national campaign.
Right.
I mean, we've got the Good News Club thing going on. Now we have the In God We Trust thing. And I realize that we're not arguing from an incredibly strong position here, because in one of the more darker episodes of American history, In God We Trust did become the national motto.
Yeah, well, it was affirmed by Congress.
Yeah. But
it doesn't need.
But that doesn't mean it was founded on those principles.
Well,
certainly not. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that it has to be Pierce County's motto.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. If really they just mean any specific God, or not any specific God, but just the concept of God, might we go with Allahu Akbar? Since it means basically the same thing. It does. It means basically the same thing.
You're not talking about, that's just a name for God.
Yeah, it's just a name for God.
Think of your own God when you say Allah.
Historically, it's the same God. I mean, really.
Yes.
But.
And in fact, this actually could be addressing some of the exclusivity concerns that Talbert and Ladenburg have to say Allah, because, hey, we're doing this in different languages. That's inclusive, right?
Right.
That'll go over really well.
But here's the thing. When someone says, oh, well, I didn't mean a Christian God in particular. Think of your own God. That doesn't even fly, because you certainly wouldn't pray to Allah. And well, then what of those of us that don't have any God?
Well, we're talking about Jim McKeown. He makes his Christianity and his alliance of Christianity and his politics part of why he gets elected.
Right.
You know, in that part of the county, that will fly very well. But what I really like is just this continual, cognitive dissonance, revisionist history that this country was somehow founded on Christian principles.
Yeah.
You know, you letter the Danbury Baptist, the Treaty of Tripoli, we can go on and on and on, where they say directly in English, in modern English even, mm-hmm. America was not founded on the principles of Christianity. They are patriotic. They do want to be inclusive. They are saying, they are absolutely correct about what they're saying, but they're not talking about the United States.
Right.
They're talking about their little dominionist utopia where people like me get put in jail or exported.
Right.
They don't want me included. They don't want people like us included.
Nope.
Well, I think tomorrow, Sam, Monday afternoon is when this is up for discussion, and then Tuesday is going to be the resolution, whether they vote on to approve it or not.
Right.
And
right.
I think you may be heard at that point.
I think I may show up.
Yeah. I think you probably should, Sam.
Yeah, Monday's usually my day off, but I think I might make an exception in this case. So, and just to talk about the kind of country that we would live in, should this dominionist concept actually come to pass, we would live in a country where a guy like this gets respect instead of ridicule. Pastor Bert Farias, the founder of Holy Fire Ministries, recently claimed in an interview with Charisma magazine that individuals who choose to be gay become possessed by putrid-smelling demons so stinky that they drive pigs to suicide. He also claimed that an unnamed prophet of God told him that God allowed him to smell this demon spirit, and he got sick to his stomach.
Wait. God allowed you to smell the stinky gay demon?
Yeah.
And not become gay yourself.
You smell what Satan is cooking, apparently?
Pastor Bart certainly didn't choose to be gay. He just accidentally got a whiff of the gay fart demon. And,
right. So if you smell it, is this how this works? If you smell it, you get infected and now you're...
Zombie gay farts?
Yeah, I don't know.
This is...
You're just trying to say the word fart as often as you can.
Yes.
Okay, can you stop that? I think that what we have here, and I had an idea, we talked about this earlier. Yeah. This should be statted up as a D&D monster.
Absolutely.
Like something epic level, I have a stench, I am, strong against fabulousness. I don't know. But it's amazing that these are the people that we are supposed to pay attention to. That according to people like Jim McKeown, these people are the salt of the earth. They are the backbone of the nation. And what they're telling us is that, homosexuality comes from demons that fart.
Fart. Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin. And, this happens so much when people talk about demons and stuff like that. In fact, early on, D&D would just raid the Bible for monster ideas.
Yeah, totally.
We should do a supplement book. They got the open gaming license with D20 rules. So you can, we should just make demons, D&D monsters based off of these demon concepts that priests seem to be, pastors seem to be coming up with every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So not the demons that are described in the Bible per se, but sort of an apocryphal edition.
Yeah.
Illustrated?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, absolutely. I'd like it to be illustrated.
Yeah.
But
it should be. Yeah.
If I illustrated, it'd be stick figures. I'm not really...
I'm sure we could put out a call to our listeners to illustrate these demons.
Yeah. We should post this story somewhere so that it could be seen.
Yeah.
And we can get some of the details on. Maybe we should call the guy and ask him, like, what are the percentages to attack? What's his armor class?
I want to know phenotypically how one describes the fart demon.
Right.
We should get like a really, really in-depth biological illustration going,
Yeah.
I liked how what we were talking about earlier with the how this idea came about, like the 6-year-old going like, gay people are icky. It's like a demon.
Oh, yeah.
Like a fart demon.
Yeah, what?
A fart demon. And then he comes out and he runs into a pig and the pigs go in the water because they don't like it because they're trying to wash themselves and they end up drowning. It's one of those 6-year-old ad hoc narratives.
I love it.
Yeah.
So
ridiculous.
So listeners, you can also get your 6-year-old to illustrate this demon.
Yeah, absolutely. Geez.
You know, there might be a test in that.
Yeah.
I mean, you get some random 6-year-olds and say, come up with a monster and
see. Does it out-monster the pastor's fart demon?
Well, no. I'd be looking for, like, some not similarities like, you know, are they the demons of homosexuality? Because that's obviously a product of hate. But I think there's going to be this idea of fart demons and pigs and smells. And this is really, like, yeah, first, you know, second grade boy thinking.
Yeah.
It really is. And
totally.
I wonder if strong parallels could be brought.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
And you
sure
guys
either.
Are educators. How often do you guys come across this sort of thing?
I've been an educator of high schoolers for a while, and I would say that it occasionally, you know, the odd 14-year-old freshman might, you know, find this fun. But hey, I'm finding this hilarious. So.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I did work with the younger kids, and yeah, about like first, second grade, they can come up with some really interesting ideas of like demons and bad guys and different scenarios in which they try to kill each other, because that's what they do when they're, you know, first, second grade boys.
There was that episode of Doctor Who where I forget what the name of the episode was, but it was like this guy who absorbed other people. That demon came up from, or that bad guy or whatever the heck it was, came up from a drawing that some kid made and submitted to the show. And they said, oh yeah, we'll turn this into a bad guy. And then you were talking about you can get like pictures of pictures sent in and they make stuffed animals.
Yeah. This I can't remember the name of the company off the top of my head, but like they say, oh, well, if your kid draws a picture and sends it in to us, we'll make a stuffed animal of that drawing. And they've turned out totally cute. I love them.
I love at our local Museum of Glass, there's bona fide glass artists that will take children's drawings and then create those drawings of those monsters into glass art. But see, I think this is sort of the inverse of that. You have ostensible adult people, adult leaders.
Yeah.
Come up with a description, and I think we should have the 6-year-olds draw it.
Totally. I agree. I think this could be a fundraiser. We should do this.
Yeah, I like the idea of, like, in our monster manual, having the kids draw the pictures.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know that I want to expose 6-year-olds to these diseased minds that think that homosexuality is caused by demon possession and methane.
Or let alone that anyone chooses to be gay or not chooses to be gay, or
right.
if there's anything wrong with that. You have a fair point there, Sam.
I wouldn't want to put that anywhere near any kids. But the hits, they keep on coming.
Yeah.
It gets better. In a recent post on the Answers in Genesis website, Ken Ham, of the loser of the debate with Bill Nye, wrote that millions of dollars have been wasted in exploring space because the Bible clearly states that the universe was created for man. Ham's article says that aliens couldn't exist because if they did, they couldn't be saved. I do believe there can't be other intelligent beings in outer space because of the meaning of the gospel. You see, the Bible makes it clear that Adam's sin affected the whole universe. This means that any aliens would also be affected by Adam's sin, but because they are not Adam's descendants, they can't have salvation.
That doesn't even remotely make sense.
Well, it means that
there's a logic to it. It's
it means
silly,
that
broken logic.
The pigs that fall victim to the fart demons also can't be saved because the pigs are not descendants of Adam.
Let it go. Let it go.
No, don't go there, Sam.
Well, what I really liked is he said, I got it wrong. No, this is a post on Huffington Post. It's all over the place when he said this. And it's like, no, everybody got it wrong. I'm not saying that aliens
are going to hell.
We shouldn't fund NASA because aliens are going to hell. I'm saying aliens are going to hell, so we shouldn't fund NASA. I wish I had the quote with me. I just forgot to grab it. But yeah, he's basically, this is not what I said. There's no intelligent life here on Earth, so why should we find intelligent life elsewhere? Yeah, I'm speaking of sixth grade humor.
Well, there's certainly no intelligent life at Answers in Genesis.
No.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah,
I do like the clever deceptions. I will not say they're good people. I will not say that they have anybody's best interests in mind.
The Answers in Genesis folks.
But there is cleverness in deception. And I think that sort of cleverness does take a kind of intellect, and sometimes credit where credit is due.
Who was deceived by this?
Yeah.
We should defund NASA because aliens are going to hell? Who was deceived by that?
This? Nothing. But we do also have that whole intelligent design from a few years ago, and they got a few people with that.
Okay, yeah, fair.
There was something there. And you know, so we shouldn't underestimate people who want to hurt things, I guess is what I'm saying.
What I'm puzzled by is everyone is damned, but you're only capable of being saved if you're a descendant of Adam. That means that he even really thinks that, like, animals and intelligent creatures, like cetaceans, those are the porpoises and whales, elephants, you know, all of these animals are also damned. Is there an animal hell that Ken Ham believes in?
I actually don't think that they believe that animals have souls anyways. Like, it's not part of the design. They were created basically for us, not... You know,
that would make heaven kind of boring.
Right.
And he must really hate all dogs go to heaven. This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Halea, a school in Uganda that was recently burglarized by people I could say some choice words about.
It's less than 1 month until the Atheist Alliance of America 2014 National Convention comes to Seattle August 7th through 10th. Get ready for an awesome lineup, including Rebecca Goldstein, Steven Pinker, Richard Carrier, and Horace Gilgamesh. See and meet locals Rebecca Bitzman, Bob Seidensticker, and Sam Mulvey. Register for this family-friendly event, co-sponsored by Seattle Atheists, by visiting atheistallianceamerica.org. Discounted student rates available. That's atheistallianceamerica.org.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince and I want to hide $1 billion in your locker.
Wow, $1 billion?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy, just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists, with a rational worldview informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communication succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Secular humanism is a non-theistic view of the universe built on a foundation of reason, science, and democracy. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking, and we hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of freethinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. For information on how you can be a part of the humanist activities in the Puget Sound area, become a member of the Humanists of Washington today. Visit humanistsofwashington.org.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air for $5. you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. Becky, you made a connection in the break that you were like, oh, why didn't I say that? I always love it when people do that.
Oh, yes. I was so excited because we were just talking about the pigs that can't stand the homosexual demons.
Yeah.
And we moved right on to Ken Ham.
What?
Ham.
Oh.
Pigs.
Yeah,
ham. Okay.
I mean, yeah, that it's there, but what do we do with it once we've got it?
I don't know.
That's always the problem with those jokes. Anyway, we first heard of HALEA, the Humanist Association for Leadership, Equity, and Accountability, in our conversation with Bill Cook, director of the Transnational Programs at the Center for Inquiry. HALEA is a place that combats superstition and cultural dogmas to empower youth facing desperate circumstances in Kampala, the capital of Uganda. When it came to our attention that HALEA had been burglarized and vandalized last month, we quickly connected with director Kato Mukasa and learned little more about the organization, the burglary, and how we can help. Joining us now to talk about it is Norm R. Allen Jr. He's the founder and former director of African Americans for Humanism, an initiative of the Center for Inquiry. As part of a long career in the worldwide promotion of humanism and skepticism, he visited Uganda 3 times and has been in close contact with HALEA since the group's inception in 2008. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Norm. Can you explain to us a little bit what your interface with HALEA has been?
Well, I first learned about the organization back in 2008 when they were founded. But before their organization was founded, there was the Ugandan Humanist Association, and they're an offshoot of the Ugandan Humanist Association. And I was involved with that organization when they were first founded. That organization was founded by a man named Deogratiasi Sekataleko, and he was a very, very passionate secular humanist, and he was very charismatic. And his emphasis was upon children. He believed that the best way to have a strong African continent with humanist values is to reach the children first. So he put a lot of emphasis upon children. And some of that emphasis was upon fighting against corporal punishment in the schools, which is a big problem at the time. And he and his organization were largely responsible for helping to get corporal punishment removed from the schools. And he was also interested in having private schools, schools for learning, schools that teach children humanist values and to build humanist leaders for the future. So that's where I first got involved with the Ugandan humanism. And in 2008, when this offshoot, HALEA, was formed, I got to know Kato Mukasa, and I've really been in his corner a great deal. Back in 2013, just last year, we had an organization that I belonged to, which is still in existence, and that was the Institute for Science and Human Values, founded by the late Paul Kurtz. And I was the editor of their journal, The Human Prospect. And in our journal, Volume 3, Number 1, our Spring 2013 issue, we had an excellent article by Kato Mukasa where he's discussing what he and his organization was doing in Uganda, and it's been very impressive.
So it seems like HALEA definitely keeps that focus of youth and children. Can you sort of describe some of the things that they've been doing to work with some of the Ugandan youth there?
Well, I think that this is one of the best humanist organizations in the world, and I've been around the world. I've been, as a humanist activist, involved in various humanist undertakings, not only in North America, but in Africa, in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, in Europe. And this is one of the most impressive organizations I've seen. What they have done is they've gone into the worst slum area in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, and that's the Gugubi Parish. And what they did was they noticed that there were teenagers in there that were really suffering in various ways, especially as far as high school dropout rates were concerned. When they went into this this ghetto with so much suffering, they noticed that people were there, and a lot of these young teenagers, for example, were getting pregnant. And once they were being pregnant, they were being turned away by their parents. They were being expelled from the schools. And they felt that this is something that required a strong humanist response. So they went in and dealt with a lot of these young mothers. They gave them a lot of social support. And what they were able to do was to combat a lot of that hostile environment and give them nurturing. They were able to show them a different way. They were able to show them things such as sex education, and they were able to show them how to develop their own businesses, you know, how to make a way out of their predicament. And they also noticed that there were a lot of teens that were involved in abusing drugs and selling drugs and what have you. And they were going about giving them a good education and teaching them that there's a better way. And this organization was primarily founded by journalists, by lawyers, and other professionals. But their emphasis was on the poorest people of society.
You know, speaking of journalism, something really caught our eye, and that was Open Talk magazine.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, as the editor of several volumes of and journals, what are your thoughts on getting young people to write?
Well, I think it's excellent. That magazine that you just mentioned has been very impressive, and it gives young people a chance to express themselves. In Uganda, especially, you have a lot of the older people, and many of them are religious, who really don't think much of what young people have to say. They don't respect their views or their right to express their views. But this organization and this Open Talk magazine gives them a chance to talk about their activities, their interests, and they get to talk about things that a lot of the older people don't think they know much about. And I just think it's a fantastic magazine and a fantastic opportunity for young people. If you go on their website, you'll see they have many blogs, such as Teens Without Borders. They have an entertainment club and an entrepreneurial club and various other things, such as the Young Mothers Club.
Yeah,
and it's excellent.
To bring it back to Haleah, one of the initiatives that we've seen has been an edutainment club that performs secular plays, music, and dance, meant to educate and challenge cultural and religious practices and promote that, you know, discrimination of women, girls, young mothers, and LGBT stuff, which we've been hearing a lot about, you know, in the urban poor, just sort of educating not just people in the school but without the school as well about humanist values. Have you seen any of these performances or anything, you know, have you seen how this plays out?
Yes, and it's not just in Uganda, but humanists in Africa in general use these types of ways to get the message out to the people. And the people really get into it. They really get involved. Back in 2008, when I went to Uganda, not only did they use plays, but they also used music. They use they have humanist songs with humanist lyrics, and people really get into it. And to see this is something that has been going on in Africa for several years, and it's something that works. You know, people enjoy it. It's not just a form of entertainment, but it's, as you said, edutainment, and people are getting an education. And it's something that has been used in numerous ways. For example, back in Zambia, back when they were fighting for their freedom, you had people like Kenneth Kaunda, who eventually became the president of Zambia, their first president, who was going around, and they were using plays to get people involved in fighting for their freedom. So this is something that goes back in African history, and the Ugandans have used it very well.
I think it's a really powerful tool. My co-host Bridget here, you were involved in the plays from a religious perspective.
Absolutely.
So to see that turned on its head and promoting humanist values and education through entertainment, through song, I would imagine to be just as powerful.
Absolutely. Probably even more so, just because it's reaching people that wouldn't normally see something like that and making it more accessible than they would normally have. It's quite powerful.
And also African dance is another way to get the message across. When I went to Nigeria back in 2004, when we had the first major humanist conference in sub-Saharan Africa, we had dancers, great African dancers and great African singers, and the music was fantastic, the dancing was fantastic, the singing, everything. And that's a very good way to get the message out, you know, and a lot of people who might not be interested in sitting around listening to lectures will get the message if you can put it to them in an entertaining way.
Yeah. So we have all of this really rich activism that's going on in Kampala with Haleah and across the continent. But about a month ago, Haleah offices were burglarized. Can you tell us a little bit about what you know so far about what happened and sort of the effects that happened to Haleah's offices?
Right. Well, before their office was burglarized, there were other burglaries in the area, and theirs was hit, and it was very unfortunate because they lost a lot of their very important information, or a lot of their important equipment, such as computers. There were 6 computers that were taken. They lost a printer. They lost a camera. They lost 3 guitars and a lot of this other important equipment that they use to get their message out. And one of the people who were one of the security guards, he had wound up unconscious, and that looked a bit suspicious. But in any case, I was really upset to hear about that, and I guess it was just a matter of time before it happened. But what they really need is support from the humanist community worldwide, and they're richly deserving of this support because they are able to show that humanism is a very viable alternative to religion. And like, as I said earlier, they can go into the poorest communities and get people involved. And a lot of people who have never heard of humanism will respond better to what they see as opposed to a mere lecture. They see people in the community, and they see that people care about them, and they see that they don't have to come in carrying Bibles or promoting religion or a belief in God. And so I think that the entire worldwide humanist community needs to get behind this organization and support them to the best of their ability.
Absolutely. Now, I know a lot of people tend to want to send specific items like toys or school supplies or medicine. Why are monetary donations preferred in this situation?
Well, they prefer money basically because they can better purchase what they need with the money. A lot of times there are differences in electrical outlets, for example, and
yeah.
If the money goes I've noticed that myself when I was over there, that a lot of times you mean well to send them something that, you know, it just really won't fit with their particular system. So to send money there, it would better benefit them, and they would better be able to get on their feet more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an educational institution. It seems like, you know, that it's a school, and schools need to have operating budgets just to be schools. I would think that they would best know how to spend resources. So I think there's a really strong case for organizations like this. If they ask for something specific, that's great, but most of the time they just need operating capital to keep operating, which I think is really important.
Right. They did lose some cash, in fact, because of some of the cash that they lost, they were supposed to use to pay for rent for their building. And so, and there are a lot of expenses that they have to cover, and there are a lot of programs that they have. Not only did they lose equipment, but they have a lot of programs that they were trying to put on, and these are very good programs, you know, programs for young mothers, programs to feed the children of young mothers and things of that nature. So a lot of that money would really be put to good use.
So do you get the sense that Haleah was targeted specifically because it was a humanist organization that challenges some of the religious status quo, or do you think that this was sort of a symptom of other burglaries that happen in that particular area?
Yeah, I think it was a symptom because, as I said, there were several other businesses in that area and other organizations that were also hit. And I don't really think that it had anything to do with their particular focus on secular humanism. I believe it was just a matter of there was an opportunity. You know, there were various instruments and equipment to be taken. There was money, and I don't really think it had much to do with the fact that they were secular humanists.
It's certainly a relief to kind of hear that.
I know it is for me.
Because oftentimes the humanist or the free-thinking community in the U.S. hears of Uganda really in light of the legislation that's very harsh against the LGBT community. And so some people might just have this idea that anything that's not religious, you know, might be be targeted in Uganda, but it's quite refreshing to hear that there's so much activism, rich activism, and several schools. I know you were involved in the Mustard Seed School. We've heard about Kasese, which is another humanist primary school in Uganda. So it's quite refreshing to hear of that kind of activism that's going on. Do you know what Haleah's next sort of things are on their horizon once they get their supplies all replenished?
Well, they're interested in getting back into a lot of the things they were doing before they were hit. The Young Mothers Project is something that they're really interested in because they see that a lot of the young mothers there are not only ostracized from their communities, but they have problems or trouble supporting themselves. And I think that that's one thing. But they're also interested in these debates. They have these excellent debates, open talk debates.
I've seen a few of the YouTube clips of them.
Right. And they really discuss things that need to be discussed. They talk about government corruption. They talk about the rights of women and so many of these other issues. And what's really impressive is that they've been able to attract many dignitaries, such as members of parliament, university professors, religious and cultural leaders, political party leaders, and various other opinion leaders who have freely shared their views on a lot of the important issues of the day. And so that's something they would really like to get into, but they really haven't had as much support as they would like to from the Western world.
So as part of those debates, it's sort of an instruction in rhetoric. Is that what I'm getting?
Well, the thing is that they're discussing a lot of issues that aren't usually discussed in public, and that's something that's very encouraging. They're getting people involved, and they're making an impact. You know, they're not just having these issues presented on a very small basis or to a very small crowd. These issues are taking on significance. These are issues are becoming broadcast on national television. And to get something like this on national television in Africa is a very major step in the right direction.
And the kids who are, or the young people that are participating in these kinds of debates, these are essentially some of these urban poor or the young mothers, and they are participating in these debates?
Right, and that's what's so beautiful about it. It's a way to take humanism to the masses, to the grassroots, and that's something you just don't see for the most part anywhere in the world, but they've been able to do it, and it just shows that if you have that passion and if you have that interest, you know, if you let the grassroots people know that you're behind them and that you're interested in democracy and human rights and in improving life in the here and now, they'll get behind it.
I think that's definitely just, you summed up that perfect marriage between humanism, activism, and really using it as a platform to really improve the world and improve our human condition. So it's quite buoying, even in the face of hearing the challenges that they're going through with their burglary and their security guard being brutalized. And so I think there's some really awesome things on the horizon. Now, you had mentioned a few of the websites, the blogs that the young people use to keep up with things, but the main website, I'm understanding, is haleahuganda.org.
Right, and if you go to that website, you can find out so much about what they're doing, and also they have a donate page where you could feel free to leave a donation for them to help them get back on their feet.
Yeah, and in my research, I know that the International Ethical and Humanist Union is collecting funds for Haleah, but then Haleah also accepts donations directly. And so I think for our listeners, we'll have those links up on our website at askanatheist.tv where people can definitely help out the efforts of Haleah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Norm R. Allen Jr. is the founder and former director of African Americans for Humanism, an initiative of the Center for Inquiry, and as part of a long career in the worldwide promotion of humanism and skepticism, he visited Uganda 3 times and has been in close contact with Haleah, the group, the school, the humanist school that we're talking about today, since the group's inception in 2008. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, talk to you soon. So this is Ask an Atheist. 206-420-0997. We're going to go a break. When we come back, have a moment of science.
Mm-hmm.
It's less than 1 month until the Atheist Alliance of America 2014 National Convention comes to Seattle August 7th through 10th. Get ready for an awesome lineup, including Rebecca Goldstein, Steven Pinker, Richard Carrier, and Horace Gilgamesh. See and meet locals Rebecca Bitzman, Bob Seidensticker, and Sam Mulvey. Register for this family-friendly event, co-sponsored by Seattle Atheists, by visiting atheistallianceamerica.org. Discounted student rates available. That's atheistallianceamerica.org.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran.
And we host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. We invite a rotating panel of our friends over to talk about science fiction, comic books, movies, horror, animation, professional wrestling, video games, and George freaking Lucas.
It's a warts and all look at popular geek culture, where we tip sacred cows and use profanity while arguing about children's entertainment.
Think of it as the McLaughlin Group for nerds.
Find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We got some folks to thank. We get to thank Richard from Kent, the other one, the one in the United Kingdom, Rick from Elma, Washington, and Xander from Tempe, Arizona. Hey man, how's it going? They all met Peggy's challenge this week. Peggy's challenge is the challenge to the listeners of Ask an Atheist to help keep us on the air. And if you would like to participate in Peggy's challenge, you can go to askanatheist.tv and click on the friendly yellow button in the right-hand corner, and it will take you right to our PayPal page. But for now, we have a moment of science.
Today's moment of science is about keystone species. Perhaps you've heard this word thrown around in the news, in politics, or maybe even in biology class. Keystone species are important indicators of an ecosystem's health and are vital to the wellness and diversity of their habitats, but what exactly is a keystone species and why are they so important? In masonry, that is, stonework, in order to complete an arch like, say, the underside of a bridge, stones are stacked along curved braces, starting from either end of the bottom of the arch. This eventually results in two curved lines of stacked stones that meet in the center. Once the two sides come together, a specially carved center stone, the keystone, is placed between them at the peak of the arch so that the weight of each side pushes evenly against the other. After the keystone is placed, the braces can be removed and the arch will support itself. However, if the keystone is then removed, the entire arch will collapse. Think of this arch as a metaphor for a healthy ecosystem. This means that the keystone species is one that cannot be removed without having a tremendous negative impact on the entire system. In that, keystone species have effects on their surrounding environments and the other organisms and cycles within those habitats that are disproportionately large when compared with their actual population sizes. Some examples of keystone species are the purple ochre starfish, gray wolves, and sea otters. The purple ochre starfish, Pisastero crassus, is a marine predator of the intertidal zone with a varied diet. They're not very fast, and as a result, some of its favorite foods are the more or less stationary patches of mussels that cling to rocks, pilings, and other substrate. While Pisasters are relatively few and far between in their habitats, their constant consumption of their bivalve prey leaves some places bare, so that barnacles, chitons, anemones, snails, worms, and other critters have a place to settle, room to spread out, or places to hunt their own prey. When Pisaster is removed from the system, the mussels become overpopulated and may even cover the substrate completely in dense carpets, leaving this formerly diverse ecosystem nothing more than a wasteland of mussel monoculture. So removing Pisaster really results in a disaster for everything else in their habitat. Gray wolves, Canis lupus, were nearly hunted to extinction in much of North America from the 1800s through the 1960s. It was believed that we'd be better off without them killing our livestock and that human hunters could pick up the slack of keeping deer, elk, and other prey species in check. Unfortunately, this was not the case. Without the wolves to chase them and keep them on the move, deer, elk, and other ungulates overgrazed their usual territories. Considerable damage was done not only to grasses and shrubs, but also young aspen, alder, and willow trees. The loss of these deciduous trees caused crashes in the species that depended on them, including yet another keystone species, the American beaver. The ensuing loss of beaver dams spread the damage from the forests and plains to the aquatic systems that flowed through them. Sedimentation increased, water temperatures rose, stream banks eroded, and fish populations collapsed. All this just from the loss of wolves. Throughout the 1700s and 1800s, sea otters, or Anhydra lutris, were hunted for their pelts from Russia through Alaskan waters and down the Pacific coast of North America. When hunting them was finally outlawed in 1911, as few as 1,000 sea otters remained in the wild, and their complete extinction seemed very likely. The reduction of otter populations carried dire consequences for our coastal ecosystems. Sea otters are very active predators that make their homes in the coastal kelp forests that support thousands of marine species. The otters are also the guardians of these amazingly productive ecosystems. Kelp forests are dominated by giant species of stromatopile algae that provide food and shelter for their inhabitants. These massive kelp forests also act as breakwaters, protecting coastlines from excessive erosion caused by the waves of winter storms. The giant kelp are anchored in place by their holdfast, which is a fleshy tissue that attaches to heavy rocks on the seabed. The kelp is grazed upon by sea urchins, which, as it happens, are a favorite food item of sea otters. Without the otters controlling the urchin population, the holdfasts were soon chewed through, setting the giant kelp adrift and out to sea and causing the ecological collapse of numerous species of fishes and invertebrates, and the literal collapse of coastal shorelines as erosion undercut them. Thanks to some very devoted people, the otter's story has a happy ending. Despite low genetic diversity, their numbers are on the rise, and with them, the kelp forests are returning to some of their original ranges. Gray wolves' numbers are also rising, though there is significant controversy regarding their expanding ranges. Despite the obvious evidence of the wolves' important ecological roles, some still oppose their return. Pisaster, the purple ochre starfish, isn't so lucky. An extremely deadly outbreak of an unknown disease has decimated their numbers across vast sections of the Pacific coast. It's not yet known for certain whether this disease is purely bacterial, viral, or a combination of multiple diseases, nor do we know if it's an entirely new illness or an old one that has been exacerbated by climate change or other factors, as the disease is often preceded by warmer than average temperatures. What we do know is that populations of Pisaster, a vital keystone species, have been severely damaged throughout its range. Worse yet, the disease has spread to numerous other starfish species, some of which are also keystone species. What happens next? We just don't know. But one thing is clear here. Humans are a keystone species too. We have a power to destroy or to restore nature that is unparalleled in any other species. We can be either the best or the worst thing that happens on this planet. The choice is ours. I'm Dan Lombardo, and I hope you enjoyed this moment of science.
And this is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. And we've got an email from Andy of Louisville, who writes, "About 3 years ago, I married the love of my life. My wife of 3 years is the love of my life and a Christian from a conservative Christian family. This is usually a recipe for disaster, but we love each other and for who we are, and we vowed not to try and convert each other. Our relationship caused quite a stink with her family, especially her father. Recently, my father-in-law upset my wife by grilling her about losing faith, and then wanted to conspire with her to convert me. While I want to think that he honestly only wants the best for my wife and me, he is not respecting our marriage vows to each other. My wife asked me to let her handle this, at least for now. What should I do? Now, this is a good question for this particular trio, because we've all kind of had to deal with this one way or another, but
yeah.
I think you more recently than I.
Absolutely. I was raised religious, and my father is an aspiring minister, and so when I married Dan, recently from Moment of Science, he joined the church for me initially, and when we first started dating when we were young, and just together the two of us sort of explored various options within religion, and then sort of simultaneously came to the conclusion that religion wasn't for us. So my dad frequently blames Dan for my lack of faith, and I've had this conversation with my father several times, in that it wasn't Dan, it was me, and I actually identified as atheist before Dan did, just because it was my decision, you know, it was something that I had decided for myself. And we used to have conversations with my father about the nature of our atheism and why we left the church, but recently, about a year ago, I guess, my father, we actually had to stop having these conversations with my father, because he decided to use his religion to sort of attack us for being atheists. And we've come to a conclusion where, you know, we respect each other in that. But I think, like, if I were in your situation, because I've been in your situation, I would sort of, I mean, you have to trust that your wife understands her family structure better, and to, I mean, still have the conversation with her, but ultimately let her sort of show her parents that you are, you know, a good person, and that you don't need to be converted, and you know, just be the positive humanist that you are, just sort of let it be known to them that you are good and don't need to be converted.
So you would actually say, Bridget, that let his wife, who said, "Hey, let me handle this for now," let his wife do that.
Yeah.
For this time, but then between the two of them, have those really serious conversations.
Absolutely.
It sounds like they're having those serious conversations, yeah. Really. I mean, it sounds like the problem here is specifically with the in-laws. It's not really with your wife. So I guess
right. What
I might do is... What I might do is, I have no problem being a little tactical with people now and again, as you guys know. But what I might do here, were I in your situation, is try to cut your wife out of it as much as possible. If
what do you mean by that, Sam? That's a
out
little...
of the out of the conversion conversation.
Ah.
So go to your in-law and say, okay, you know, not so blatantly, but give them opportunities to try and convert you without your wife present, so that your wife doesn't have to feel this sense of conflict she has about her personal identity as a Christian and her vow to you to keep, you know, that you guys like each other the way you are and you love each other for who you are, not what you believe. And, you know, because, I mean, now she is going to have a lot of turmoil. There's going to be the collision of what she believes and her love of her family and her love of you. So,
yeah, but that could also backfire badly.
I don't know if it could. Well, honestly, if it's going to backfire, my sense is this. If it's going to backfire, it's going to backfire anyway.
But what you're saying here is kind of, hey, Andy from Louisville, conspire with your wife. Say, hey, let's cut out the you taking the heat for all of this.
Yeah.
And let me go to dear old dad and have him, you know, have his best go at converting me.
And as Michael Caine said to Batman... persevere.
Well, I worry that it will create a tension between him and the in-laws. That's
not his fault, though.
And I think that tension is already there.
That tension is there because he has already the conspiracy has already begun, because his father-in-law already tried to conspire with his wife to convert him. His wife went to him and said, "This is what's happening." The tension is already there. The damage, if things are going to explode, they're gonna. But you're not gonna keep it if you just run away. I think that'd be worse overall.
Perhaps.
Yeah, she also said, let me handle this. And I sort of side with her to be like, I know what's going to happen, and to let her sort of deal with her family the way that she would choose to handle it.
She also said, hey, let me handle this at least for now. So yes. There may come a time when it says, hey, you know, what do we need to do? I'm not getting anywhere with Dad on this. And it might be, let me handle the side with Dad for now, but you and I can discuss other things and other tactics.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that he do this without his wife's knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Because you can't. I mean, that's silly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I want to bring up is really how impressed I am that not just that you vowed to not try and convert each other, but that was actually part of your marriage vows.
That is really cool.
We get a lot of people saying, you know, oh, I like this girl. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but she's an atheist and I'm a Christian, or vice versa.
I'd actually like to know more about that.
I would. Andy. So, Andy from Louisville, tell us about what those marriage vows look like, because that's a really interesting sort of dynamic to have that promise to each other right off the bat.
The other thing is to be publicly an atheist in a family, to be the non-believer. There are benefits, not necessarily to yourself, but I think, like, one of the things that I've noticed, and I've mentioned this before about, you know, my father-in-law, but even other members of my family, even with my own family, is to say I'm an atheist or I'm a humanist, and to be publicly about it. I mean, I can't hide it now, and I do a radio show. gives other people the idea that they're not alone if they don't quite believe as the rest of the family does. Not even to say that they're, you know, oh, I'm also an atheist and I'm glad that you're the guy taking the heat. But it's like you provide the space for some level of polite disagreement, especially if you stay polite. And that's what I mean by persevere, is that one way or another, this guy's going to try and convert you. And I'm going to say, and not something I usually say, but under the circumstances, I think roll with it.
Yeah, I could see that.
I like that, you know, Andy, you say right up, hey, that father-in-law, he's not respecting my marriage vows to me between me and my wife. Well, it's a good thing you married your wife and not your father-in-law. Father-in-law doesn't have to respect those marriage vows.
That's often true, I find. I mean, the reason I would even suggest that to begin with is because it sounds like you and your wife are actually have a pretty clear understanding of each other and a real respect for each other and a love for each other. And I wouldn't suggest that if there were more doubts. But unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for today. Okay. So this is Ask an Atheist. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. Email us at questions at askanatheist.tv. My name is Sam. With me was Becky Freeman and Bridget Lombardo. Our guest was Norm Allen. Technical assistants were Nick Kennedy and Sharon Zanowski. Writing was by Dave Brulette and Becky Friedman. I am the producer. See you guys next week.